Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, as we have for the last 32 and a fraction years, we begin the Tech Net, which is a gathering of curious people who want to know more about wireless equipment, ham radio equipment in particular. So they gather here and help each other figure out how all this stuff works, how to make it work better, what's the best rigs to buy. We don't necessarily recommend particular brand names, but if a particular unit's got a very good track record or a not-so-good track record, we tend to tell each other about that. A person signs this TechNet by giving this group of four guys your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment for the net. The group of four guys are K2RIW, his name is Dick, you're listening to him, John, KC2WGB, and John monitors the EchoLink website, among other things, and he also is the collector of information for the mailbag for people who don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly. So they send him emails, snail mails, pigeon droppings, and we sometimes get some really challenging questions from these guys. I see a great future for the younger upcoming hams. Let me drop. We also have Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report. And I'm guessing that this particular space report, I've got to guess as to what number it's going to be. 147 is my best guess as to what the next report is on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration, among other services, building space hardware, what they've been doing. And there's always some exciting things going on there. Along the way, we are helped out by Hal, K60PZ, who has a lot of experience in all kinds of radio equipment. Let me drop it. And he's going to be telling us tonight about a project that he has been planning. Now, a group construction project that, if approved by Mark, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, could become a club project for people who like building things with their hands. Alrighty, now's the time for you guys to sign in. If you do have a question or a comment, you need not sign in just because you're listening. After 32 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. When you go to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, you will see that it says that we're 33 years in the business. Well, this is our 33rd year, but until September of this year, we haven't really reached 33 yet. It's 32 in a fraction. Let me drop. And that website I just mentioned for mic number one is a very handy one, because the last 7 years of TechNet, thousands of hours of TechNet have all been recorded. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and each one of those four or five reels that are 1 hour each, and you can play back TechNet. Some of the people who are unable to stay up late, we go on until midnight, and then get officially cut off at midnight. Let me drop. For some people who can't stay up that late, what they do a couple of days downrange when the recording appears on the website, they download that recording and listen to it while they're driving to work or on their lunch hour or whatever. So there's all kinds of ways you can hear the whole thing then. Another very handy website for you to go to is mic number two, K1MJM, which is the URL of limarktechnet.com. There you'll find pictures, articles, and other helpful information that is compatible with the commensurate compatible with the TechNet itself. So, mic number one and mic number two, if you get a chance, thank them for the yeoman service they're doing, giving us lots of information for those who need TechNet information in the intermediate days during the week when it's not Sunday. Okay, time to take those check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. K2RIW listening.
K2BYH, the name is Al, Alpha Lima.
It's Leo, yes. Okay, I got Al, Alpha Lima, K2 Delta Yankee Hotel, and Rich N2EO. Anyone else, give me a call letters and name right now.
Sierra Romeo.
Yes.
mic. You start talking, then you squeeze. The first one I heard was blank, number two, Sierra Romeo. Sierra Romeo, please give me your full call and your name, and squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then talk. Sierra Romeo, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. W2OSR, and fast reaction time from working net early in the morning. Got to change my mode here.
Well done, Rob. We got you that time. Who is the other person? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW.
VBN.
Okay, that person was so fast on talking and not the squeezing and waiting. I heard VBN. Give me the full prefix. Squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then give me your full call letters and name, sir. Mr. VBN, go right ahead. K2RIW.
KB2, VBN. Question.
Okay, KB2, VBN. Apparently his name is Question. What is your name, sir? I think I know you. Go ahead.
Freddy.
I think that's Freddy from the Rockaways. Okay, we got you, Freddy. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, leave it space. You're off your bet on this figure.
Why? Joe? Yes.
Okay, I heard Eric and Joe in that order. W2RYY. We got you, Joe. One last call. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, Paul with the space report. Good evening, Dick. John, Al.
Pretty fine, Paul. We're looking forward to taking that number. I made a guess before of 147. Maybe number 147. We'll soon find out. Okay, first person who signed in was Hal. K2 Delta Yankee Hotel. You've got us, Hal. Wait for the beep, and then K2, and then... And please proceed with your question.
K2DYH, name is Al Alpha Lima. Good evening, Dick and Danette. I have a question about vertical antennas for HF frequencies. In the past, the vertical antennas required radials to be buried in the ground. But now some of the manufacturers have come out with verticals that do not require any radials. And I was wondering if this is just a lot of hype, or is there some magic that was made with the antennas? So back to you, Dick and Danette. K2DYH.
XDTZ with a quick answer.
Yeah, as you're about to find out, Hal, there's good news on this one. This is not hype. This is real. I will first get the quickie answer, and then quite possibly I'll have to expand it to make it a little bit more understandable. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead and help.
Everybody on the TechNet. Okay, basically, it's not hype. What they're doing is basically it's an instead half-wave antenna. Now, with an instead half-wave antenna, it's not necessary to have a counterpoise. They're driving the antenna at the high impedance end on the vertical plane, and it works. So there's my quickie answer. Now, Dick, you can expound on it. K6DPZ.
That's good information, Hal. I'm going to expand it a little bit. Everyone, for traditional reasons, when you're building an ordinary dipole, say, for instance, for 80 or 40 meters, 99.9% of us always feed it in the center. By tradition, we are led to believe that the center is the only way to feed the antenna. If you've got the right kind of a balancing device, you'll discover there's no magic place to feed it. Feed it dead center if you want to, 10% off to one side, 50% off to one side, 90% off to one side, or all the way over to one side. And you want to know what's happening. If you go to that set of curves called the Brown and Woodward curves, the Brown and Woodward curves are available in any edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4. And this is where Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward spent a man year of their life back in 1965, measuring, in 1945, 46, they spent a man year of their life taking every possible diameter of radiating rod, every possible diameter, every possible length, every possible frequency, and by the old-fashioned technique with slotted line and slide rule, They laboriously calculated the exact impedance of every antenna at every lens. Let me drop. One definition of all of that is the bottom line is that as you move off to one side, in the center of the antenna is 72 ohms. 50% off to one side, maybe it's 300 ohms. When you feed the outer ends of a full half-wave dipole, and there's no insulator in the center, it's now one long piece of wire, half wavelength long, you feed the outer end, you're feeding something like 1,500 ohms or 2,000 ohms of impedance. The slight disadvantage is now you need some kind of an impedance step-up device. When you're feeding a 1,500 or 2,000 ohms, you can't do that directly with a 50-ohm cable. You need an L network, and a single inductor and capacitor properly designed will do that beautiful step-up impedance for you. When you're feeding a monopole antenna that's only a quarter wavelength long, it's the center of a half-wave dipole. Let me drop. The center of a half-wave dipole is 73 ohms. If you're feeding only one side, and the other side is a ground plane, you're feeding a roughly 36 ohms. When you're feeding a 36 ohm quarter wave long monopole antenna, your ground plane radials better have an impedance that's very small compared to 36 ohms. Otherwise, you're putting more energy into the ground plane than you are into the radiator. So that takes an extensive set of ground plane radials. If you're really serious, you put down 32 of them. Sometimes four or six of them is almost enough. But when you're feeding the outer end of a half-wave antenna, where it's a couple of ohms of impedance, if your ground plane radials now are a small fraction of 2,000 ohms, if it's only 200 ohms, it does the job. A stake in the ground is a good enough ground plane radial when you feed the outer edge. So half-wavelength resonators, and just because the resonator, the thing that's radiating, is a half-wavelength electronically. Let me drop. The further magic is that the radiator itself does not have to be physically a half wavelength long. You can make it a quarter wavelength long, but by loading inductors in the center and top hat capacitors at the end, by doing the fancy things you can do, zigzagging it and coiling it up and whatever, as long as you can make it electronically a half wavelength long as a resonator, regardless of its physical length, and you feed the outer edge of it, you're feeding an extremely high impedance, and very little ground plane radials will give you 95% efficiency, if you know what I mean. So it's not hype, it's real. And it's just good antenna engineering in a slightly unconventional manner. Most of us are very afraid to feed the outer end. In the early days, they did that all the time. It was called an N-fed ZEP. ZEP meaning the Zeppelins, the airships, the blimps. You only had a wire hanging out the back end of that blimp, and you were, by definition, feeding one end, and they discovered very rapidly that nothing but the blimp itself, which is a small fraction of a wavelength, let me drop. The blimp itself is a small fraction of the wavelengths they were using in those days. You know, it's a big object. They were using such low frequencies that that was probably 10% of a wavelength long, and it was a perfect ground plane counterpoise system. Because they were end-feeding a very high impedance antenna, the end-fed ZEP. So in the early days, they did it. For about 40 years, we forgot about it. And you could say we're rediscovering it, Al. And it can be real if they're telling you the truth. It really is a half-wave electronic resonator. K2TYH. K2RW. You got it, Al.
Thank you, Dick and Hal. Very good information. I'm glad to hear that this is not a lot of hype and that it's actually a practical thing to do. These antennas run about $500 to $600, so I really didn't want to get into something that is not going to work. And I appreciate all the information. So back to you, Dick and Hal.
Now, you're a guy, Al, who probably has a fair amount of resources, and therefore, in your particular world, writing a check and making the problem go away is a good solution. If you wanted to be more of an experimenter, and if you wanted to be more frugal, for you to build with your own hands a half-wavelength resonator on these frequencies, you could probably do it with $50 worth of materials. You go to the right website about half-wave or end-fed antennas. Let me think now. The J-Pole is one of them, for instance. It's a kind of a half-wave end-fed antenna. It's So if you did some research, you could save yourself a whole lot of money and do a lot of experimenting, if that's what you want to do. It's very similar to the guy that wants to get into astronomy. Does he go out and buy a good telescope, or does he start grinding his own mirror? And each approach can give you a lot of pleasure, as long as you know what you're getting into. To grind your own mirror, you're probably going to spend a year of your life, but you're going to learn an awful lot about parabolic shaping of substances by grinding them. And you'll know more about what's really going on inside the telescope. You write a check and you buy a good cast-a-grain telescope these days, you can get an awful lot of some very good observing. And so each one of our hobbies, you can do it in the scientific manner, what's the word I'm looking for now, the appliance operator manner, or everything in between. The choice is yours. It's a very variable hobby. There are 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, and you're into one of them, Al. And good luck with that, Al. Good luck with that. And so when you do decide what you're going to build, you install it and test it out, come back and let us know how it worked out. Next guy on our list was Rich in 2EO. And what would you like to talk about tonight, Rich? We'll discuss anything except installing antennas at your home. I'm having some fun with him. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich. Make sure you wait for the beeps, even though I don't.
Okay, Dick, and sweetheart, yes, you must have been listening to me. I know you've been listening. Yes, I've been contemplating a big antenna, not a beam, just a vertical because of my medical situation. As you know, I had a leg amputated, so I need to have something put up that can be maintained easily. And I want to hire Woody, K2UU, is par excellence in installing antennas. And what I'm considering, among others, is what Howard put up, DPC, a high-gain, high-tower. It's a vertical that's got studs. And it covers, it's 30 feet of tower, aluminum tower, and above that, 30 feet of mast. And it covers 80 feet head. And the add-on kit go down to 160. It interests me because I'm not a DXer. I want to use 160 and 75 meters. Now, my property is a corner lot. House sits on an 80 by 100 piece of property. It's very big. I don't want to have any surprises. You mentioned Massapequa. I'm actually in Massapequa Park. There's North Massapequa. There are none of them. I'm in Massapequa Park. I don't know how to approach this. I had called the building department for Massapequa Park. They had no idea what ham radio was. They confused it, they thought it was CB, and it was old school, and nobody does that anymore. Anyway, a building inspector was here the other day. Big work done in the houses, you know. And I said to him, what do I do? Well, he's going to look it up in the code book, a very friendly guy. He's going to be back when we finish the building work. He's going to tell me, but what do you think, Dick? He said I might need, not an engineering study, he said an architect. I'm trying to keep the cost down, and I don't want to put it up on out of surprise from the village. That's what I'm worried about. Back to them.
I have a couple of comments on this one now, Rich. And after I make my comments, I'll throw it open to the net if other people have further information. You're in a bit of a gray zone, in my opinion. I'll give you my example. I moved in 1969, put up 100 feet of tower, and in my particular case, there was no ordinance for height of structures in 1969. And the first thing I did was to put up the tower even before I put in all the furniture in the house. I had moved furniture from one house to another. I did put in the bedroom set and the kitchen table, but the rest of the furniture waited until the tower went up. Well, 6 months later, they wrote a tower ordinance or a height of structure ordinance. And so I should have been grandfathered. And everything was hunky-dory for the next 15 or so years until a complicated situation occurred where uh, uh, a, a commercial installation on the property alongside of mine by the Motorola company was going to be installed. The people in the town were against it. They asked for my testimony as a so-called radio expert, and I talked about what possible interference they could get from the equipment that was going to be installed on the Motorola tower. And I said that as long as the company installing this particular service would happen to be a taxi cab, a truck dispatching service, let me drop the phone, that those services did have some history of creating some local television interference, as long as the company installing that equipment will admit that it does create interference, and as long as they're willing to install these high-pass filters, which was about a $5 item, to the nearby neighbors or nearby for about a block in each direction, the problem would go away. I gave that testimony. And all of a sudden, the Motorola person who was in charge of that district, he filed an anonymous complaint against me, and he's not supposed to do that. He violated the Motorola policy, and he soon was no longer an employee, and I think the two are connected, so that he violated Motorola policy by filing an anonymous complaint. And that created a situation where I was in a zoning court for quite a long period of time, and eventually got settled. So many an amateur has the attitude of put it up, as long as you've got a good working relationship with your neighbors, all is hunky-dory. Many are doing that way. When you go to a town that has no specific ordinance, has no specific wording for ham radio, let me drop it. And the village, hamlet, or whatever it is, Massapequa Park, may not have any specific ordinance. They don't know how to handle it. And so it becomes complicated. I mean, in some cases, you better let the sleeping dog lie, if you know what I mean. What's the worst that can possibly happen? And that is, if you put it up and then somebody filed a complaint and then they start a zoning case, they have to prove that you're really violating a written rule, which you either do or don't have. There's also a PRB1, which is in your favor, which loosely defined says that there's supposed to be use normal common sense for ham radio operators. Most towns will allow you to put up almost any kind of a structure for television reception. There's many an amateur who, on the top of his tower, put the television aerial. And so because you're a guy that doesn't like paying high prices for cable television to get digital television, you like getting digital television over the air, and because you're 30 miles from New York City and you get marginal reception unless you've got an antenna, to put your television antenna on top of the structure, or to call your structure a television receiving antenna. It does cover those frequencies, maybe not very well, but it covers those frequencies. It is your television aerial. And so, loosely defined, PRB1 or some of the FCC rules say that you're allowed to put up almost anything for television reception. And as long as you can confirm that this is not such a big, high, heavy structure, that if at worst it fell down, that it would cross the property line and hit the neighbor's house and break the window. I mean, you know darn well that your structure is not going to do that. So, should you go and ask the question where they don't know how to answer it, or just go and do it, that's not an easy one. As you can tell,
repeater, time out.
As you can tell, various people have handled it various ways, usually successfully. As time goes on, most townships, even Oyster Bay, you're in the township of Oyster Bay, and they have approved a number of amateur radio installations. I've been to some of those zoning hearings. Your township is basically in favor of ham radio, even though your little village or hamlet of Massapequa Park may not know about it. So go ahead and investigate it further. You might decide to just go do it. And as I said, more than half the guys have done that successfully. And the worst that can happen is that they start asking questions and you start giving them information about how safe the thing is. That's one approach. I bet you guys that listen to me have got other approaches. Please give me your call letters right now and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB would have come in.
Go right ahead, John, and wait for the beeps, even though I didn't.
on the net. Yeah, Dick, the only thing is, I think he's mistaken. An architect can't handle that. He's going to need a PE, and it shouldn't be that much. But if his contractor, you know, makes up a sketch, let a PE stamp it, and he should be fine.
Good comment. Yeah, professional engineer. There are a number of amateur radio operators that are professional engineers. You get a hold of one of those, they will charge you a fortune. You're putting up a commercially recognized antenna that has known dimensions, weights, and whatever. So to take one of the engineering drawings of your antenna that Hal's going to tell us more about, I'll bet you 90% of what the professional engineer desires to stamp off is already there from the manufacturer. I hope that's true. Let's find out. K60PZ, who recommended that antenna? K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
Technet K60PZ. If you're interested in doing a Hightower antenna, Hightower, all the engineering diagrams and all the other technical information, if you go directly to High Gain, or which is MFJ, you can get all the engineering data you need. You don't need a PE to draw it up and do the specifications. The High Gain will supply you the specifications, Richard.
So once you've got that paperwork in your hand, Rich, and 2EO, you've got 90% of what's required to then find an amateur radio operator, professional engineer to sign off on it is rather easy. Once you have that validation that this is a safe installation, I'd like to believe the town will give you no real grief. And so what you're putting up is an antenna. I recommend you do not call it a tower. It is an antenna. The thing below it, you've called a tower. Don't use that word. That's an antenna support structure. It's all part of that antenna. And so if worst comes to worst, you might have to claim that it's a television aerial. But I don't think you're going to have to go that far. So I'd recommend you just go do it. Have somebody anonymously look into the town. You might not have to do that. And then buying your own copy gets a little bit complicated. It'll make you feel a little uncomfortable because they'll sell it to you for $35 or $40, but you've got to give them a name and an address. They've got to know where it's going. And so to do that anonymously is a little bit more difficult. But to read the town code yourself, or to have a volunteer go there and do it. And what you're going to discover is almost all town code. Let me drop this. Almost all town code. As you read the individual chapters and verse, you're going to find conflicts. You're going to find out that a church steeple and a flagpole is allowed to be ridiculously high. And where does a flagpole end and a vertical antenna begin? It's a darn interesting question. So you'll find exceptions and chapters that don't quite hang together. Almost all town code has that. So the zoning board literally has the ability to choose the chapter they like and ignore the chapters they don't like. And you bring to their attention at a zoning hearing the chapters that they don't like. They say, well, it doesn't apply in this case. And you ask them why it doesn't apply, even though the wording specifically says such and such. And you won't get a direct answer. As you can tell, it's a bit of a mishmash. And I can tell already that your town doesn't know the difference between ham radio and citizens band. From their point of view, they're both radio emissions, and as long as it's not a commercial installation, I'd like to believe they can keep it slightly non-confusing, but who knows. It's not an easy one, Rich, and I don't think you should lose a whole lot of sleep over this one. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
If you put a flag on top of the antenna, would it interfere with its performance?
Darn good suggestion.
Cross, it shouldn't affect it at all.
There you go. Now a flag wouldn't affect it at all. So if you put a flag on top of it now, it really is a flagpole. So I would, as anonymously as possible, try to find out what the town code is. You're going to find out it's confusing. Almost all of them are. And so you're putting up a very unusual flagpole, as I see it, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, take N2EO. Well, I just don't want to have a problem. I hope I didn't open a can of worms. This inspector I was here because I told you I'm having construction in the house, unrelated. And I mentioned it to him, and he said he's going to go through the code book and let me know next time he's here. Now, I've got one neighbor who's very close. I'm on very good terms with him, but you know, that can change rapidly. In the other direction, I've got the house. The other way, I've got trees in the neighborhood way. And then there's nothing the other direction, Cartwright Boulevard, and the house across the street. So I think I'm in good shape there because I want a big piece of property. But, you know, I've had my medical problems. I just don't want to have to go into court.
Because of your medical problems, they're going to be very reluctant to force you into court. In the past, amateurs had some grief. 90-some-odd percent of the time, it was because of television interference. Nowadays, almost nobody, with rare exception, is watching over-the-air television. And even if they are, they're doing it with digital equipment, which does give them failures periodically. And so, for them to blame it on the ham radio operator next door is almost out of the question. And since 90-some-odd percent of the people are all on cable TV, you're not going to be creating television interference. And your structure, although to you it is beautiful, shiny, and big, it's not that massive. For it to do real damage if it fell is extremely rare. Is it going to affect property values? That's the only thing that people are against ham radio operations in the past. Television interference, that one's gone. Is it really big enough and heavy enough that it can do destruction? That's not your case. Is it big enough and bright enough that it's going to be affecting property values? That's out of the question. So I think you're in very safe grounds. So your building contractor, he's not going to give you a nice direct answer, Rich, because there is no direct answer. If he spends the time to dig deep enough into the town zoning code, he's going to find it's very conflicting. All of them are. Let me drop.
Man.
I heard comment, go to you in a second. The main reason why some of them are so conflicting is that almost no town wants to spend the thousands of man hours to write zoning code. They copy somebody else's. In the case of each of the individual towns that are part of the township of Oyster Bay, they probably copy major sections of the Oyster Bay zoning code, building code. And as such, and then they add their own things on top of it at times, which may even make it more conflicting. So you're not going to get a clear answer from that guy that's looking into it. If you had an attorney who really understands zoning code, he would be able to give you a good answer. That's going to cost you some more money. Person with a comment, who was that? Give us your call it as a name, and then your comment. Please wait for the four beeps. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Ed, K2GJE. Frank Fallon may be able to help him. W2FF, I believe he's in Williston Park. Over.
Yeah, he sure could. Frank N2FF, who was our division director for a good number of years, he personally worked on multiple years of attempt to get New York State law that added to the PRB1 federal pronouncement to try to get the real state law making it legal for ham radio operators. New York City did do something like that. New York City has a rule that the first 75 feet of an antenna structure owned by an amateur radio operator, no permit is required. Just go do it. The first 75 feet was free in the five boroughs of New York City, is my understanding. Nassau and Suffolk is dragging their feet on that one. And Frank was not quite successful, but he's a good guy to talk to because he was heavily involved into it for a long period of time. So thank you, Mr. GJE. We'll go over to Bob now. W2OSR. I'll discuss anything except antennas. What would you like to talk about, Bob? Having some fun with him. W2OSR, K2LAW. You got it, Bob.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and good evening to everybody on the TechNet. This is W2OSR. This is by way of referring from a question from another amateur radio operator, Mike Kulak, KD2AMZ. He ran across something called an EH antenna. I've done a little research on them, and there could be some controversy. The guys, of course, that are trying to sell this product claim it's the most wonderful thing that's ever been invented. And there are other people who said it's nothing but snake oil, and that the antenna doesn't radiate, but the coax does a great job. Over.
3-5, Bob. That last comment is most of us. When I first opened my consulting business for radio and antenna research, starting in 2000, and I was working for a particular vendor that needed an extremely small, high-performance antenna, and they wanted me to seriously consider the EH. And if you dig deep enough into the website on the subject, you'll rapidly find out it's more than controversial. 95% of the people believe it's snake oil, it's hokum. There were a number of broadcast stations that predicted that they were going to invest a significant amount of money building an EH antenna, and therefore they'd be able to abandon their broadcast tower, save a whole lot of money for the amount of real estate required for the guy wires and whatever. And you rapidly found out that all those broadcast stations, both in the United States and in Europe, particularly in Holland, they did a rather serious experiment. And you never heard about them after that. And so they rapidly came to the conclusion either they were doing it wrong and it wasn't working, or the whole idea is wrong. In my opinion, everything I know about radio radiation, radio emission, radio transmitting, tells me it's wrong. Because the whole philosophy of that antenna, let me drop it. The philosophy of that antenna is that an ordinary radiator, which is resonating and radiating, is a electromagnetic structure, an electromagnetic transducer. It's got a strong local magnetic field, it's got a strong local electronic field, and emits this wave into space, where everywhere that wave has a given amount of E field and a given amount of H field, magnetic field, and the ratio between the two is 377 ohms, and it's a planar wave at a long distance, and everybody thinks they know what that wave looks like. And the philosophy of the EH antenna is that if you separately generate the E and you separately generate the H and let Mother Nature combine it in free space, that there's some kind of magic technique by which now a much smaller structure generating the E, because it doesn't have to generate the H, and a much smaller structure generating the H, because it doesn't have to generate the E, and that even though these two structures are essentially co-located, but they're going to be independent from each other, and because you've generated those two components separately, that some kind of magic is supposed to take place with greater efficiency, greater bandwidth, higher gain, and more hokum. It's pure bull. I've dug pretty deeply into it. I've talked to people who have experimented with it. I have not found one real successful operation where somebody said, I built this, this is the performance, and I love it. You dig deep enough and you're going to find 95% of the articles say it's terrible. 5% of the guys have questionable information that is not really verifiable. And so I am a non-believer. And just like a cold fusion, if you know what I mean, a couple of people think they saw something, but the vast majority cannot reproduce the results. I wouldn't spend a lot of time on it. Go ahead and research it because it's a fun subject. But the whole philosophy seems to be wrong by everything that I know.
Repeater, timeout.
So as I said, the whole philosophy seems to be very wrong by everything that I know, Bob. Make sure you wait for the four beeps. W2OSR, K2RIW, the tech net.
Okay, Dick, thank you. It kind of confirms my gut feeling. All right, I'm going to sign out of here and go relax and join my wife watching a movie on TV. And I'll get the word to Mike the next time I talk to him. 7-3, everybody, W2OSR.
And Bob, let us know what Mike finds out. He may have started off as a believer. On paper, at first, it sounds too good to be true. That's usually the truth. If something sounds too good to be true, often it's too good to be true. I think this is... So let us know what you find out with your further research on this one. Freddie, KB2VBN. What would you like to talk about tonight? KB2VBN? K2RW, you got it, Freddie. Wait for the beeps. Now, this is about the fifth time that that has happened. Every time Freddie checks in, when we go over to him, he's not there. Freddie, I'm going to give you one more chance. KB2VBN. You're number one on the runway right now, Freddy. K2LIW. I think Freddy likes to hear us say his goal letters. Okay, Joe, what have you been into this last week? W-H-O-R-Y-Y, a guy who usually challenges living daylights out of us. Go easy with us tonight, Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K2LIW.
Okay, only two timeouts so far. You're doing pretty good. I'm only kidding. My question has to do with multiple element antennas. I'll be fairly specific in exactly which way I'm going to which way this question is going to go concerning a television antenna, and they have a certain specification that is called the front to side ratio, and say arbitrarily the antenna gives you a rating of so much forward gain, and say the front to side ratio is say 25 dB. My question is, looking at a particular target at 90 degrees to your center bore of the antenna, how much can you go either way? How many degrees either way do you think you can go before you start losing that that isolation in the whole antenna? I guess it may change also per frequency. Back to you.
One of the very rare things that doesn't exist with television aerials is a real three-dimensional antenna plot that is made by measurement, not by simulation. If you did, you would find out a television aerial looks like an apple. By that I mean it's got some deep dimples on the side. It's an apple with multiple stems, so to speak, when you see it as a three-dimensional plot. And each one of those dimples on the side, which represent the front-to-side ratio, are fairly narrow. Now, how narrow? If your definition is 25 dB down, it might be 2 degrees in azimuth, 2 degrees in elevation. Darn narrow. And you go 4 or 5 degrees away from that side, and the 25 dB of rejection is now 14 dB of rejection. So if you really need extremely high front-to-side, front-to-back, or front-to-any-other-angle ratio because you're getting co-channel interference. Let me drop. If you're really getting co-channel interference, one of the best ways to get rid of co-channel interference is a co-channel interference eliminator. In other words, it's an assemblage of two separate antennas. One antenna is aimed at the desirable target. One antenna is aimed at the undesirable target. And as a sort of a phased array, you combine the two antennas with a power divider where you have, it's a power divider circuit where you have the ability to adjust the phase angle and amplitude of the undesired signal. When you mix in just the right ratio of undesired signal with desired signal, you can take any antenna in the world that has any front-to-side ratio and make that front-to-side ratio for your environment go to any number you want. 20, 25 dB is easy, as long as you're willing to put up two antennas with a fancy combiner. Whenever, let me drop. In the old days of cable TV television, where in the old days, the cable TV front end, like the one out in Hopog, I think it is, or is it Farmingville? Anyhow, the one here on Long Island, it used to be a high tower with antennas aimed at New York City to pick up the main channels. There were some other antennas aimed in other directions to get rid of the co-channel interference. So that's the way it was done in those days. Nowadays, each cable TV company taps into the source directly by fiber optics, and they don't have to do over the air. But back in the days when cable TV front ends were done
over the air.
Let's hear more about that from Eric. So back in the days when it was done over the air, these co-channel interference networks, I think, were very popular then. And so I guess they've become a thing of the past. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, make sure you wait for the beeps. K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Actually, all the cable stations have the traditional head end, except now they've become digital. In the olden days, like, you remember Jim Nishimura had his stuff up on the hill there, on the 90-foot phone pole. Of course, we use single channel antennas that had a very high side rejection with front-to-back ratios. But there was a problem in those days is that each one of your offending co-channel stations has an offset of 25 kilohertz plus or minus, or 35 kilohertz plus or minus, which actually made, you know, you could never null the stuff out completely. You could minimize it, but you would still see it crawling through from the difference in frequency. That was the only thing about that kind of a setup. Now today, same things apply, except now, chances are that your symbols are going to be masked by the co-channel, and as much as you try to tweak it out, good luck. Keep trying, WKJW.
Hey, give me a couple more words on this, Eric. Are you telling me now that even with digital over-the-air broadcast television, that there are cable TV organizations that are getting that over-the-air broadcast signal literally over the air, not by fiber, and therefore they're putting up fancy antennas, trying to get the highest gain in the desirable direction, the most amount of rejection in the undesirable direction, and in some cases building co-channel interference eliminator systems? So you're saying that there are cable TV companies gathering the raw data over the air and not making an arrangement with the original broadcaster by which they could get the high fidelity signal by fiber optic. So what percentage of the cable TV companies out there are doing it that way, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RIW, K2K, well, let me give you a little bit of a picture here. First of all, there's Comcast out in New Jersey. They pick it up, particularly over there. They don't have any fiber. Actually, in the case of WNET, WRIW, and New Jersey TV, it all originates up to Syracuse, comes down via a 2G fiber, which actually disseminates multiple places. Currently, all the stuff actually terminates here in Plainview, then gets distributed to the closets of CBS on 57th Street, and it gets distributed to the Empire State Building, it gets distributed to where the studios are on 50th Street, and it goes to Warner, New Jersey, which winds up in Trenton. So there's a whole bunch of paths. Now, in that process of the path, like in the CBS closet, I'm going to let it drop. The signal is handed off to a fifth, which is actually handled by Time Warner, which winds up going to, that one goes to Avenue of America, which is ABC, in their closet, and that gets handed off to Time Warner's distribution network, you have the cable vision, and a couple of other things. So, the other day they had a problem with that path, meaning the cable companies weren't getting their cable feed, their fiber feed, so they had to all switch back to the over-the-air antennas, which are looking at the transmitter at Empire State Building. So, it is not the primary path, but it is the secondary path, and they do put a lot of effort into using directional, no log KIs. These are all single cut. And literally hand cut antennas per channel that they're aiming for with the highest rejection possible in terms of co-channel. And as far as co-channel filtering goes, in the analog days that worked wonders, where you actually wound up getting a picture of how it works in the digital world, I actually don't know. That's right. Actually, I ought to talk to one of the guys at Cablevision and they have to say that. HRIWK2GI.
From my point of view, Eric, if a person has enough understanding of phased array antenna technology and the way RF really behaves, that tells me that if you've got a Yagi with high enough front-to-side ratio because it's been hand-cut for that particular channel frequency, and if you want the next step of improvement in co-channel interference, in other words, a signal from another broadcast center on the exact same frequency, from some other direction. I mean, you may be listening to New York City, and maybe there's a single channel that has the exact same frequency down in Washington, D.C., which under normal circumstances doesn't get here. But it arrives at some other angle, and you aim another antenna in that angle, and you set up a co-channel interference rejector, suppressor, call it what you like. The fact that the real data that's modulated is digital, it's got a trellis to it, as opposed to analog. That doesn't matter. It's still the same RF carrier. What you're describing is more elaborate amplitude and angular modulation techniques of that RF carrier. But if you can reject that RF carrier in analog, I guarantee you can get the exact same number of dB of analog rejection in that direction with digital. So the fact that now digital, I'll admit, is more difficult to align. Let me drop it.
I'll argue with you.
Because of that 25 kc of offset, which gives you bars across the screen as that weaker signal comes through from some other area, and you adjust the balancing network to eliminate the bars, or, let me see, you can't do it on a spectrum analyzer because it's on the exact same frequency. So you've got to do it by looking at the real video display. Now, in the case of digital, to look at that display and decide that those digits are the desirable ones and these digits are the undesirable ones, I'll admit that's going to get very difficult. I think if you look at the so-called bit error rate detector, and you adjust the co-channel interference eliminator so that the bit error rate detector gives you the most desirable number, I think you stand a chance. I'll admit it's going to be a lot more difficult. Give us some more words on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer locally, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's somebody playing with it, Edmerick. Let's get something straight here. The analog world is way more forgiving than what we've always got. RF is RF, I don't care what you're modulating with. As you well know, if you want to null something out, you need the inversion of it. And it needs to be the same frequency, so that way you have the same exact phase happening at the same time. Days of analog television with the offset, you could do a really good job, but you could never get it really perfect because you're dealing with the tolerance of a crystal and all that. It's getting multiplied up. You know, things weren't GPS locked in those days, actually. Even time wasn't locked anything other than if you were listening to CBS, they happen to have a cesium standard that they drove the rubidium standard with, which drove the first. But that's a whole other story. In the digital world, anything that really disturbs the signal, the symbol, because don't forget, you got a random number generator going. It's just sort of a random number that fills up the blank spaces, so to speak. And if that demodulator just even slightly misses an edge, everything's off for the next, 188 bytes worth of data. It takes a little while to recover. When you get the code channel, I'm sure the guy who's always watching and doing DXing on TV, when he gets his antenna somewhere where there's code channel happening, I think he simply goes away. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, part of what you were worried about, Eric, is that, yes, in theory, to get a really deep null, you have to have the exact right amplitude of the inverse signal, opposite in phase, at that exact frequency. And so because the channel is 6 megacycles wide, that sounds very difficult. If you're smart enough to realize that your main antenna does have an electronic phase center somewhere in the middle of that antenna, that your co-channel interference detecting antenna, the other antenna aimed in the wrong direction to the bad channel, also has an electronic phase center. If you're smart enough to make the lengths of cable between those two antennas that come back to your combiner the same length of cable, then to make that system 6 megacycles wide, plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees of phase error, relatively easy if you're smart enough to look at it that way. If you just try to randomly choose lengths of cable between those two antennas back to the co-channel interference canceller summing network, if you choose random lengths of cable, yes, this whole system will drive you crazy. To get 6 megs of bandwidth to the nearest 1 or 2 degrees, and 1 or 2 degrees of error can give you numbers like 35 and 40 dB of rejection. And I think in the real world, if you've got 15 or 20 dB of rejection, most of the time I think you're home free. Yes, it's going to be a rare situation where the code channel is because of what's the word I'm looking for now? Forward-propagated tropospheric scatter or super-refraction phenomena. Mother Nature will periodically give you an atmospheric condition by which that signal that's 10 times further away in miles happens to be stronger than your local signal. That's a rare event. When that occurs, now you need really good rejection of your code channel interference circuit. That's going to be hard. I'm going to give you that one. But is it possible that in the digital world, when you're doing that final alignment, where you're adjusting the phase and amplitude to try to get that null real good, that if you look at bit error rate, that it gives you a pretty strong indication of when you're going in the right direction? Is it a little bit like that sight-impaired person walking up a hill where the tilt of his feet tells him when he's going in the right direction? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, in terms of digital television, let me give you two magic numbers, okay? Signal noise that the receiver's got to see is going to be 2070, okay? Receivers really start to lock up at, say, minus 19, minus 20, if you're lucky. And if all things being equal, if I had a source, a co-channel source, and I had the exact length of cables between the antenna and the main antenna and the combining network, and I was able to control the phase of it so that I can, in essence, I should be able to cancel 100% of the offending co-channel signal. Doing everything right. By the way, in the cable world, they think they're doing everything right, but they forget a few things here. I know, I worked for one when I was a kid. If you get to the point where you're reaching, on the main signal, minus 20, minus 22, 23, by tweaking your co-channel phase and getting it so that it's down low enough, you're going to get a good error rate that's going to work, okay? Not to say that Mother Nature isn't going to give you a kick in the rear every now and then. And when that happens, okay, your consistent, reliable image will now have gone blocky and possibly disappeared for a moment, and then it came back. So that's the issue here.
Now, since the ham radio operators doing moon bounce have occasionally run into a situation, I'm going to show you something that is a real trap you can fall into. And if you're smart enough, there's a way to get out of it. Assuming now you really know the phase center of the two antennas, one's aimed at the desirable antenna direction, one's aimed at the undesirable signal. And you make those two cable ends exactly equal to each other, and you go into your combiner, and now you're adding two things in phase with each other, and you want them to be out of phase. So therefore, common sense would lead you to believe you add an extra half wavelength of cable to one of those antennas, and now the two signals are out of phase. You could do that, but you're falling into a trap. Now one of those cables really is a half wavelength longer, and now as you sweep in frequency, the phase shift is going to continuously be shifting on you. And so you're going to get a beautiful null at the middle of the band, but 3 megs up and 3 megs down, you're going to get a fair number of degrees of phase error. If you're smart enough to realize that the two antennas are in theory identical, and now you mount one of those antennas upside down compared to the other antenna, now you're creating the 180 degrees of phase shift right at the source. Now those two cable lengths going into your combiner are truly... Let me drop
them. That's how they do it in cable head ends.
I'm talking about over-the-air reception now. You mount one of those antennas upside down, and now those two cables are truly equal in length, and now you can get phase match across the whole darn 6 megs and probably 20 megs if you want it, if you know what I mean. And so the degrees of phase error problem almost goes away if you're smart enough to do that. Now, are we talking about over-the-air RF reception of this digital signal with this co-channel interference network? Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm trying to remember, there's a guy's name. He's one of the experts that does all of these research projects, and one of the trainings have done various different experiments in terms of interference tolerance, co-channel tolerance, and how to eliminate them. The numbers can be pretty good in the real world, or rather,